This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Hello and welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing Research Associate Dr. Gemma Knowles of the Social Epidemiology Research Group at King's College London and part of the REACH project. REACH stands for Resilience, Ethnicity and Adolescent Mental Health. It took place in secondary schools in South London and it will be the main focus of today's podcast. If you're a fan of our In Conversation series, please subscribe on iTunes or your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with the rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues. Gemma, thank you for joining me. Can you say a little about yourself by way of an introduction?
Yeah, hi, Jo. It's great to be here. Thank you for the invitation. So I'm Gemma Knowles. I'm a research associate at the Centre for Society and Mental Health at King's College London. And as you say, I've been working on REACH for the last kind of 5 to 6 years as the project coordinator.
Well, let's directly turn to the REACH study. Can you give an overview of REACH and its aims?
Yeah, so REACH is a study of adolescent mental health based in inner city London. And what we've been doing is working in close partnership with 12 mainstream secondary schools based in the inner London boroughs of Lambeth and Southwark since 2015-16. And at those 12 schools, we've been working with a group of just over 4,000 young people who have very kindly been providing us with information each year about their mental health and about things that we think might increase their risk of developing a mental health problem over time, and also things that might be protective for their mental health over time. And we're now in the fourth wave of data collection for REACH. And the broad aims of REACH are to look at the extent and nature of mental health problems among young people from diverse social and ethnic backgrounds, and to understand more about the things that influence young people's mental health over time.
Can you say anything about some of the key findings?
Yeah, of course. So I guess most of the analyses that we've done so far have been based on the baseline data and also some more recent data that we've been collecting around the impacts of COVID on young people. The first thing is that data that we've been collecting provide quite strong evidence that the prevalence of mental health problems is higher in inner city London compared with national estimates for secondary school pupils. So in REACH, it's around 1 in 5 in people who have possible mental health problems, compared with nationally estimates range from 1 in 10 to 1 in 7. So that's probably the first thing. And I think quite interesting then to think about, you know, the implication being that possibly it's context matters for young people's mental health. And what we see coming out of the big national studies of adolescent mental health in this country perhaps aren't representative of different areas and different groups of young people. The second thing is, I guess, broadly speaking, that social experiences and social circumstances are strongly associated with young people's mental health. So, for example, we've found that young people who report experiences of racism are around 2 times more likely to also report behavioural problems. We've found that young people from low-income households are more likely to report self-harm and more likely to be struggling with their mental health. And similarly, factors like social support networks and experiences of discrimination, again, are strongly associated with young people's mental health.
Thank you. And Gemma, you recently published some of these findings in the co-authored paper, Mental Distress Among Young People in Inner Cities, the Resilience, Ethnicity and Adolescent Mental Health REACH Study. And that was published in the Journal of Epidemiology and Community Health. What were the other key takeaways from that paper?
Yeah, so the purpose of the paper was to describe the extent and nature of mental health problems, so general emotional distress, and then also anxiety, depression and self-harm for young people in inner city London. And I guess I've kind of given you a bit of a spoiler alert on some of the findings in what I was just saying, but I guess the three main things were One, that the prevalence seems to be higher in inner city London compared with nationally. Two, that there were quite stark gender differences. For example, girls were more likely to be struggling with their mental health, and that was across all aspects of mental health, so anxiety, depression, self-harm, general distress, compared with boys. And that difference became more prominent as young people got older. So, for example, there was little evidence for gender differences in mental health when young people were in year seven. But then among year nine pupils, there was a 2 to 3-fold higher risk of mental health problems among girls compared with boys. And the third thing is we looked at variations by socioeconomic status, or for us, we used free school meals as a marker for household income, and by ethnic group. And I think the things there is that there were some variations by social and ethnic group, but I think possibly what's more interesting is the similarities between these groups. So, for example, there were many similarities in the proportions with mental health problems by ethnic group, which is quite interesting when you consider that generally, on average, most racialized groups in this country do experience higher levels of social disadvantage and social adversity compared with white British young people. And these things are associated with young people's mental health. And so I think trying to understand more about why that's the case is quite interesting.
Will you follow up on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we've been collecting information from each participants for, as I said, for kind of 4 waves in a row now. We're in a position to be able to look at longitudinally what are the common trajectories of mental health among young people from diverse backgrounds, and what are the factors that influence the probability that young people are in one trajectory over another. So, for example, you might have young people who have good mental health throughout adolescence, young people who struggle with their mental health throughout adolescence, and others who perhaps their mental health improves or declines over time. And so we're really interested to look at what factors influence their trajectories. And in that, we'll be looking at variations in trajectories by ethnic group and what factors account for those variations.
Just touching on something you mentioned before, you said that there was an increase in prevalence of mental health issues, say in year nine compared to year seven. Can you say anything about how you account for that increase?
Yeah, so that was in relation to gender differences. And so what we observe is, and again, this is cross-sectionally and something we'll look at more robustly when we analyse the longitudinal data. But what we saw is that if you compare mental health among boys and girls in year seven, and the differences are quite small. And in some cases, there was no difference between boys and girls. Whereas then among year eight pupils and year nine pupils, that's where the gender difference really started to become quite prominent. And I think we all hear, and it's quite consistently reported, that young girls generally struggle with their mental health more than young boys, or are more likely to. And this, I guess, it suggests that, with the caveats of it being cross-sectional, it suggests that it's those early years of secondary school that where perhaps the gender difference first emerges.
Can you say anything more? Is it social, biological?
Yeah, so we haven't yet got into the crux of the analyses on that yet, but it could be a range of things, really. I think on the one hand, this could be genuine differences in mental health. It could also be differences in reporting of mental health by boys compared with girls as they get older. And it's something really for us to look into and dig deeper with our data.
Gemma, what are the implications of the findings from REACH in terms of developing strategies for prevention and interventions?
One thing is that context matters, and so we need to potentially be taking a more tailored, localised approach to supporting young people's mental health, given that in some areas young people have different experiences and therefore different risks of mental health problems compared with young people living in other areas. And so, you know, trying to collect data that's more localised in other regions of the country could be quite important for us trying to understand where the greatest areas of need are and their then be able to take a more tailored approach. I think the second thing is that, although obviously a lot of our analyses are in the early days, there is quite a strong body of evidence suggesting that social circumstances and experiences are important for young people's mental health. And I think at the moment, though interventions aren't really my thing, it seems to me that there's a lot of focus on schools when it comes to trying to improve and support young people's mental health. And that makes sense. Young people spend a lot of time in school, and it's clearly important, and it's a good place for us to be able to reach and provide support for young people. But a lot of the interventions that are being tried and tested in schools at the moment are generally things like mindfulness and CBT and so on that try to support young people with emotion regulation or with trying to cope better. And that's all fine, but the evidence base suggests generally that those kinds of interventions tend to have quite short-term and often modest impacts on young people's mental health. For some groups of young people, they're not very effective at all. And possibly some of that comes down to the fact that those interventions aren't trying to get at the root causes of distress. So if for some young people, their distress lies in difficult social circumstances and experiences, then something like a 6-week CBT program isn't really going to tackle that. So I think possibly we could be doing more to focus on social drivers of mental health. And with that, keeping in mind the fact that schools, teachers and school staff are extremely busy, overworked, and it's not really what they're trained to do, to identify young people who are struggling with their mental health and provide that signposting and support. So I think maybe it gives us some indications there in terms of what we might be able to do slightly different going forward.
That's really interesting. Does that mean, though, that given what you've said, Gemma, is it still right to consider schools as a place to focus on adolescent mental health programmes?
I mean, my personal opinion is yes, but there needs to be a multifaceted approach. I think purely trying to offer those kinds of supportive interventions in schools without trying to tackle underlying causes of distress, they're only ever, as I said, they're only ever going to have short-term and modest impacts. And so it does need to be more comprehensive and multifaceted. And the factors that influence young people's mental health are wide-ranging and complex. And so I think the more kind of different types of interventions that we can offer young people, the better.
And what about support for teachers then and teaching management? Are they sufficiently supported in implementing these measures?
I think was possibly two sides to the answer. One is kind of teachers' mental health and well-being and whether they're being supported well enough for themselves with their own mental health. And I think possibly the pandemic has highlighted the stresses and the pressures on teachers and school staff are really quite immense. And there's some research that's been happening in, I think, in Leeds and York by a group of qualitative researchers where they've been following a group of school staff over time and looking at the impacts of the pandemic on their mental health, but also asking them to reflect on pre-pandemic situation in terms of their work-related mental health. And you combine that with a body of research that suggests that teachers in this country are, their workload is higher than it is in other European countries. And teachers often report feeling that the support for their own mental health is insufficient and that the pressures and workload on them is increasing and very difficult for them. So I think there needs to be more done to support teachers' mental health themselves. And that's important because we know that teachers' mental health is associated with young people's mental health and also their learning and classroom behaviour and so on, and their self-report relationships with their teachers. So that side of it's really important. And then in terms of whether teachers feel, I guess, sufficiently supported to provide more mental health support and signposting to young people, I don't know. I'm not aware of any evidence, not to say that it doesn't exist, but I'm not aware of any evidence to say whether that's the case or not. But anecdotally, from working in our schools, teachers seem to feel quite anxious about taking on that extra responsibility where they don't already have pastoral responsibilities. And there are many teachers who work in pastoral roles who do a brilliant job on this side and are already very good at it, but there's only so much they can do. So I think any support that is put into schools, it needs to be thought through really carefully, the delivery of those supports.
So what is the message then to policymakers? Because it sounds like what you're saying is the government's focus on embedding mental health support in schools is perhaps too narrow, or a quick fix maybe.
Again, I think it's important that we come from all angles, and because different things work for different young people depending on their circumstances. So it's great to be able to do more to offer young people support in school when they need it. I think it's quite well known that there is a massive gap in access to formal mental health services for young people. So, for example, the young people who are trying to get referrals to CAMHS to get support for their mental health, there's a massive waiting list there, and there's now for quite a long time been a gap between the level of need and the level of support that can be offered. So trying to bridge that gap and offer the support in schools to young people at the point that they need it is great. But I think, as in terms of trying to tackle the underlying root causes of of mental health. If things like poverty and racism and discrimination and housing and employment are linked to mental health, then, and there's a strong body of evidence to indicate that, then these are things that are linked to policy beyond the school setting. So I think it needs a more comprehensive approach, and the more we can do to support young people and the households in terms of things like income and employment and removing racism and discrimination and so on, the better.
Gemma, how do you go about translating research such as REACH into practice to help young people and their families?
It's difficult, and we're not quite at that stage yet. So I think we've collected data over four waves, and we have so far really only got depth with the baseline data, and the longitudinal analyses are ongoing. And of course, it's important for us to get those analyses out because it's more robust in terms of the inferences that we can make from the data. So there is still a good amount of analyses that need to be before we can start really making substantive policy recommendations. And one of the reasons for that is that we've, over the last year, we've kind of redirected our aims slightly to look at the impacts of the pandemic on young people's circumstances and their mental health. And so some of the work that we initially planned to do or have done by now have been put on pause for that purpose. I think the other thing that's really important in terms of translating research into practice is the meaningful involvement of young people and local communities and their parents and schools interpreting findings and deciding what next. And this is something that we've tried to do through outreach. We've tried to involve young people and schools in every aspect of the study, from first designing the study and how it was going to work and how we would collect data and what kinds of data we would collect, but also then in terms of interpreting findings, shaping the research questions that we ask of data later on, and also in co-authoring papers and reports that we produce. And so, for example, we have a schools working group who work really closely with us on all of that. And we also have a group of young people who are involved at different levels in our research. So, for example, we have two part-time peer researchers, Adna and Karima, who are age 17, who work one day a week in our research team. They're absolutely brilliant. They make us think differently in everything that we do, I think, and really bring a different angle to our discussions and to our work. And I think that kind of thing is really important when you get into the point of trying to translate findings into practice. And likewise, we have a group of young people, community champions, age 16 to 18, who work with us through the year on whichever elements of the project they're most interested in. We have a young person's advisory group as well, a community research coordinator who recently came on board, who is trying to improve our links with local communities and local community groups so that we can really find the gaps in terms of what decisions are being made locally and how to use our data to support those decisions in an evidence-based way, but also in terms of trying to invite people from the community to advise us on what the priorities should be for our research going forward and how we can have an impact. So I guess we're not quite there in terms of shaping practice, but we're making steps toward it to make sure that we've got those good partnerships and links in place that are really quite essential to be able to do that.
Sounds fantastic. I bet it makes a huge difference.
Oh, massive. I mean, I think if anyone's deliberating over whether to put some money into employing young people in their team, absolutely go for it. It's brilliant. It really does make you think differently. And they Adna and Karima, and all of the young people we work with, actually, they really are brilliant. And it enhances the quality of the research for sure.
Well, let's turn to your work with, around the pandemic. My understanding is that you've been asking participants to take part in a new online research project to look at the impact of school closures and social distancing measures on their mental health and well-being. What can you tell us about this?
Well, first, just to say that this work is under peer review at the moment. So I guess I will outline some broad findings tentatively, but just to say that's kind of being reviewed. So what we did is, it's not actually a new study. What we did is at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic in the UK last year, we recontacted young people who had been taking part in REACH for the previous 3 to 4 years and invited them to complete an online questionnaire about their experiences and about their mental health during that first period of school closures and the first lockdown. And we've been looking at that data and comparing back to what young people have the information that those young people have provided us before the pandemic. And we were looking at first whether there was any evidence to suggest that the proportions of young people struggling with their mental health increased at the start of the pandemic compared with before the pandemic, and also whether those impacts varied by gender, by ethnic group, by social background, and by their experiences before and during the pandemic. And broadly, what we saw is that we didn't find any evidence to suggest that the proportion struggling with their mental health increased during that first period of restrictions. But that was if you look on average at the overall proportion. And generally, the inequalities in mental health that existed before the pandemic, so by gender, by ethnic group, by household income, those inequalities seem to persist, but not really widen in that early phase of the pandemic. And instead, what we saw was that it seemed to be that young people's experiences directly related to the pandemic were the thing that were associated with variations in their mental health. So as an example, we asked young people about the social and economic consequences of the pandemic for their household. We asked about their thoughts about the impact on education and so on. And for young people who reported more negative impacts directly related to the pandemic, their mental health seemed to decline slightly during that first phase of restrictions compared with pre-pandemic, whereas for young people who reported fewer negative impacts and in some cases positive impacts, for example, not having exam pressure, experiencing less social pressure, being able to spend more time with their family and so on, those young people generally seem to experience a small improvement in their mental health during that first phase of restrictions. They're the broad findings, and what we're doing now is continuing to follow that group at subsequent points in the pandemic to look at how things change in the longer term.
Gemma, what next for REACH? What else will you be looking at?
I mean, we've got a lot of data to analyse, so that's one thing. The second thing is that we plan to continue following the cohort over time. We're still now inviting young people to stay involved with us as they leave school. And when we first started REACH, young people were aged 11 to 14, so they were in school years 7 to 9, and they're now age 14 to 18. And so they're just entering that phase where they're starting to leave school, leave education, and enter that transition to adulthood. And so the next focus for us will be looking at that transition to adulthood, and which is increasingly difficult for young people now. Obviously, following 10 plus years of austerity and so on has impacted young people in that transition to adulthood, but also now the impacts of the pandemic on young people's employment and so on. So that will become our next focus. And we potentially also are quite interested to have a look at regional variations in mental health around the country, given what we found in London compared with national estimates in terms of mental health, because it's likely that this isn't just specific to London. It's perhaps representative of what the situation is in other diverse urban areas of the country as well.
And is there anything else in the pipeline that you'd like to mention?
So, yes, there's a couple of papers under review at the moment that hopefully will come out soon. There's a PhD student of ours, well, she actually recently finished her PhD, but she's recently published some really interesting work on social risk factors for conduct problems in young people, and has continued that work looking at the role of social networks in behavioural problems for young people as well, which is really interesting stuff, and that should be out quite soon. There's also findings of some virtual reality work that we've been doing, should be out soon, and of course then the kind of longer term impacts of COVID. So let's watch this space.
Gemma, what is your take home message for those listening to our conversation today?
Based on what we're finding in REACH, it's important to remember that context and experiences and circumstances matter for young people's mental health, and to try not to overlook that when we're talking about how best to support young people.
Gemma, thank you ever so much. For more details on Dr. Gemma Knowles, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelt A-C-A-M-H. And don't forget to follow us on iTunes or your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoyed the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.